When Finlay McNab learned of Colonel Fannin's latest mismanagement, he did not despair, though he was appalled to think that an officer with formal training could be so incompetent. Not only had Fannin ignored General Houston's urgent plea to abandon the indefensible Presidio, but he was also dividing into smaller groups what few forces he did have, sending badly needed troops on a wild goose chase to defend some willful civilians who should have left the area long before. After heated discussion with other concerned volunteers, McNab sought a meeting with the colonel to protest, taking Otto along so that the boy could better understand the situation in which they were involved. He reported to the corner of the Presidio grounds where Fannin had his tent. "Sir," he began. But he had uttered only that word when Fannin interrupted. "Name and district?" "Finlay McNab, Victoria. My son, Otto." The colonel acknowledged the pair, then said, "You have something to say?" "You see, sir, we live near Victoria, and we understand that General Houston wants us to retreat, in an orderly fashion, of course. And if we go to Victoria..." "We retreat nowhere," Fannin snapped. "But if the Alamo has already fallen, it was a make-believe fortress like this..." McNab had used an unfortunate word. "Make-believe?" Fannin cried. "Look at those walls. I've strengthened every one of them. I've had 700 cattle slaughtered, and their meat dried in the sun. We can withstand a siege of weeks, months, till the rest of Texas mobilizes." "Colonel..." The interview was ended. Fannin rose angrily, stalked out of his own tent, and left the McNabs standing there. Back in their own corner of the large compound, Finlay told his son, "You must remember, Colonel Fannin is a West Point man. He has his own special definition of honor, of propriety. Men with their own definitions always mean trouble for other men." "Are we in trouble?" "Deep. Santa Anna could be here at any minute. He's only 95 miles away."
"And he could break down our walls, too?"
"With enough men, he can do anything."
"What should we do?"
"Like Houston says, retreat now and fight later." Finlay delivered this prudent opinion on Tuesday, the 15th of March, and he was disgusted on subsequent days to see that, instead of preparing for an orderly evacuation, Fannin was assigning his men tasks, adding to the fortifications and storing the dried meat of the slaughtered steers. It was as if, having the fort and the food, he felt obligated to use both. But a member of the Georgia Battalion had a simpler explanation. "He refuses to join any movement which might mean the loss of his command. He will not serve under another man." The remainder of that week was spent in total confusion. Then, belatedly, Fannin accepted the fact that he really must retreat. However, even then he could not act decisively. Instead of marshaling a calculated withdrawal with firm, quick decisions about what to take and what not, he vacillated miserably, telling the men first, "We'll not try to haul those big cannon," then snapping, "We've got to take every one of our cannon. We can't let Santa Anna get them." The danger was not really from Santa Anna in the west, for he was resting with his victorious troops in Béjar, but from a much different kind of Mexican general, a soft-spoken, humanitarian professional named José de Urrea, who came thundering up from the south, sweeping before him all the American filibusters who had been harassing the Mexicans in that region. It soon became apparent that General Urrea, with a vastly superior force, could overrun Goliad at any time he wished. "We should have left this place 2 weeks ago," McNab lamented, as he watched with dismay the chaos that engulfed the men about him. "Why doesn't someone establish order?" he asked with Scottish impatience at such sheer folly. But no one did. At last, on Friday afternoon, the 18th of March, Colonel Fannin reached a decision, which he announced boldly. "We start our withdrawal to Victoria tomorrow at dawn. Since it will be a speedy retreat, we shall not try to take our cannon with us." "Thank God he's made up his mind," McNab told Otto.
and all that day father and son moved about the presidio, checking to be sure that everyone had his rifle in good condition and an adequate supply of ammunition.
"Why are you doing this?" a Georgia man asked.
And Finley replied, "Because I don't see any of the officers doing it."
"What do you know about military affairs?"
"Nothing, but I have common sense."
That night, he drew upon his fragmentary knowledge.
"Otto, I read once that retreat is more difficult than marching ahead. The book said you need speed and discipline."
"Will we have them?" Otto asked.
For although he was only a boy, he had seen enough of the disorganization at Goliad to make him suspicious of any leadership that Colonel Fannin might provide.
"Son, at military tactics, Fannin may be first-rate. It's in the management of his army."
"I don't think he knows how to do anything," Otto said.
And through the night, they continued to check armament.
At dawn on Saturday, the two were ready to serve as scouts, leading Colonel Fannin across land they knew well. Sure that by nightfall they could bring the troops to safety in Victoria, only 25 miles away. But as they were about to move out, Fannin decided that, after all, he had better take his cannon with him. And during the time consumed in making this radical change, for teams of oxen had to be assembled to draw the heavy pieces, he had a further idea. Burn all that piled-up meat, so the Mexicans can't get it. And through the wasted morning, men stacked timbers, set them ablaze, and tossed onto the resulting fire the choice meat from some 700 steers.
"This place never smelled so good," an Irishman shouted. And while the soldiers waited impatiently, another Irishman started playing a mouth organ, and men danced reels. On a day when speed was essential, for other scouts had reported Urrea on his way to Goliad, the march finally began.
"At last," McNab sighed as they set forth, satisfied that the men were at least well-armed and prepared for battle, even if overtaken from the rear, as they might well be after such a long delay. But the farce was not over. When the troops were less than a mile from the presidio, a lieutenant, checking the supply train that had been given to him to command well after the march started, found, to his horror, that all food supplies were gone. In their enthusiasm for destroying huge stacks of beef to prevent them from falling into enemy hands, the men had burned the entire lot. A file of 360 men was marching into the hot, empty plain east of Goliad with nothing to eat except what the occasional foot soldier had sequestered in his knapsack, if he had one. When news of this disastrous oversight spread through the ranks, a much more serious one was discovered. No one had thought to bring water, either, so that the big, patient oxen on which the movement of the cannon depended began to weaken from lack of it. When the McNabs heard of these incredible blunders, the sort boys would not have made when planning an overnight camping, Otto made a simple suggestion. Someone ought to shoot him.
"Hush," his father warned, clamping his hand firmly over his son's mouth. "That's treason, and Fannin would hang you in a minute."
When his mouth was freed, Otto said grimly, "Fannin has rules for everyone but himself." Foodless, waterless, this shambles of a retreat was struggling across the plain when two rear scouts dashed up. "General Urrea, with many men and 3 cannon, will overtake you before sunset." When Fannin heard this, his face went white, and now McNab felt that he must intervene, for it was apparent that the colonel had lost all sense of control and needed guidance.
"Sir, I know this land. My farm lies just ahead. You cannot allow yourself to be trapped in this open field. You must, you really must, turn quickly to the left and head for those trees along the river."
"I never divide my army," Fannin said doggedly, remembering something he had read in a military manual.
"But, sir, I know these Georgia men, these Tennessee sharpshooters. You turn them loose in those woods with water available, they'll hold back the whole Mexican army."
I do not respond to panic, Fannin said resolutely. And now, although protection was easily available after a double-time march of less than 2 miles toward the scrub oak, the mesquite, and the river, this obstinate man insisted upon keeping his men on the route he had planned for them, a dusty, waterless path on which his oxen had begun to collapse and his soldiers to gag from thirst. Finally, when the surviving oxen were no longer able to haul the big, useless cannon, Colonel Fannin had to order a halt. It came in one of the bleakest stretches of the route, an area which provided no protection of any kind, no trees, no water, no gully to serve as a ready-made trench, no soft soil to encourage the digging of real trenches. Fannin brought his men to rest less than a mile from all kinds of safety, and here, with no protection, he formed them into a hollow square, such as the Romans had used 2,000 years earlier, with wagons as occasional breastworks and the precious cannon at each corner. Meticulously, he ordered that the sides of the square run true to the compass headings, with north facing the river a short distance away, with east facing Victoria, to which they should be marching, and west facing the Presidio they had recently abandoned. It was neat, military, and fatal. Fannin had 360 men, Urrea well over 1,000, and as soon as the unequal battle started, it was clear that the Mexican must triumph. However, Colonel Fannin, with his West Point training, proved a formidable adversary, for he deployed his men well, gave them encouragement, and conducted himself like a real leader. But because the Mexicans fought a battle of swift movement, Fannin could not bring his cannon to bear upon them, and by the time the Mexican lines had formed, the only Texicans who knew how to work the cannon were wounded, and the big guns stood useless. As night fell, it was obvious to the trapped men inside the Roman square that on Sunday General Urrea could overwhelm them any time he wished. It was a horrible night, with the wounded crying for water and the unwounded watching the encircling lights as the Mexicans moved ever closer. At 3, an ox that had been hit in the shoulder began bellowing so loudly that Otto went to the poor beast and shot it. Others in the doomed square, thinking that the Mexicans were upon them, began to fire wildly. But Colonel Fannin silenced them. "Save your bullets. We'll need them tomorrow." By dawn on Sunday, Urrea had brought up his heavy cannon, with ample horse and oxen power to move them where they would be most effective. And now, with the Norte Americanos spread neatly out before him, and with not even a surface ripple on the flat to protect them, he fired at will, raking the entire camp with a deadly barrage of canister and grape. The exposed rebels, with no food or water to sustain them, had no chance of escape. 1,200 fresh Mexicans faced the 300 or so exhausted survivors. In the first 3 explosions of the cannon, fragments of metal ripped through the camp, killing and maiming. The next 3 were worse, for the Mexican gunners now had exact range. And before the next salvo could be fired, several junior officers consulted with their men and reported to Fannin, "No hope with those cannon raking us. You must surrender." But now the confused leader became heroic. "Never. We'll fight to the death." Then he lost control and watched impotently as his officers raised the white flag. To McNabb's relief, the Mexicans responded quickly with a white flag of their own, signifying that a truce existed. And shortly thereafter, Colonel Fannin, accompanied by Finley McNabb as his interpreter, marched erect and trim to meet Urrea. The 2 commanders settled upon the exact terms of surrender, and a disastrous adventure, mismanaged from the start, collapsed in a disastrous finish. McNabb, when he reported back to the men inside the square, was quite specific as to the arrangements that had been reached. "Colonel Fannin demanded that our troops receive all the honors of war, lay down our arms, officers to keep theirs, surrender with full right to leave the country. No executions, no reprisals." General Urrea did not exactly accept these terms, at least not in writing. But he did agree to an amiable surrender with our rights protected. And Lieutenant Colonel Holsinger, acting for Orea, told me personally, "Well, sir, in 10 days, home and liberty." When others on Urea's staff told us the same, and many heard the promises, we were much relieved, I can tell you. General Urea himself was less specific about the actual terms, but he was quite eager to provide us with water and food and care for our wounded. To me, he seemed both a perfect gentleman and a soldier who knew what he was doing. I did the translating up to the point where Urea and Fannin drew apart to sign a paper of some kind. What was in it, I don't know. Formal terms and all that. But as we marched out, the Mexicans saluted us, and Holsinger said again, "Well, gentlemen, in 10 days, liberty and home." Less than an hour after the surrender, the men who had marched out of the Presidio only the day before now marched back in. And when the McNabs were once more within those familiar walls, Finley told the boy to kneel beside him. "Almighty God, we thank Thee for having rescued us from what could have been a great tragedy. Teach us to be humble. Teach us to be grateful. From the bottom of our hearts, we thank Thee." He then sat Otto down beside the embers of the burned meat and lectured him on the duties of a man. "You've seen what indecision and confusion can do. I don't charge Fannin with cowardice, because in battle you saw that he was brave. But in this life, son, you must carefully make up your mind as to the right road, and then march down it. If a wall of water 40 feet high comes at you, hold your nose, kick to stay afloat, and when the water recedes, get on with your job. Promise me, Otto, that you'll be a man of determination." "I'll try." In an unusual display of emotion, his father embraced him. "I was proud of you, son, the way you helped me check the rifles the night before we started our retreat. You and I did our jobs. We did the best we could. It was the others." He would condemn no one specifically, but he sat silent for a long time, trying to understand how this debacle had been permitted. But in the end, he said simply, "We were lucky to escape. Now let's get back to work." "Since we're so close to our farm, do you think they'll let us walk home?" "I'm sure they will," Finley said, "for that would be the sensible thing to do. And since he was himself a sensible man, he expected others to behave in the same way." Benito Garza, like many historians in later years, found no fault with General Santa Anna's harsh conduct at the Alamo. A band of uninvited guests on Mexican territory had raised a rebellion, which, according to explicit Mexican law, made them pirates and subject to the death penalty. Most of the dead had been killed in combat, and those few who were shot or sabered after the end of fighting had been killed in the immediate aftermath of that battle, while tempers on both sides were still hot. There had been no atrocities. No women or children had been slain. It had been a clean fight, and the Mexicanos had won. True, Garza had experienced one bad moment, when on Santa Anna's orders he inspected the ruins of the Alamo to ensure that men like Travis, Crockett, and Bowie were dead. For as he turned one of the bodies over with the toe of his boot, he looked down to see his brother-in-law Xavier Campbell's glassy eyes staring up at him. "Dios mío, how did he get in here?" No one could give him an answer, for the women who had been inside the Alamo were too frightened to speak much sense, nor would they have known his history had they been able to report. "Men," Garza had shouted, "let's bury this one." But the scene was too confused for individualized action, and Campbell's body, like the rest, was thrown into a huge pile for burning. Later, as Benito tried to sort things out, he concluded, "Well, if he insisted on fighting against his own nation, he deserved what he got." But this did not alleviate his feeling of sorrow over his sister Maria's loss of her second husband. Of the adult Texicans he knew, Benito had liked Campbell the best. But his conviction of superiority had led him astray, and now he, like the other arrogant intruders, was dead. Benito had curious and sometimes conflicting reactions to the great victory at Béjar. I'm glad that the Norteamericanos received a stiff lesson. They deserved it. I want to see them kicked out of Tejas. But having thus exulted over the victory, he had a less inflammatory reaction. I could have lived with Xavier Campbell. He treated my sister with dignity. I can still live with the McNabs. They are decent. Perhaps if we have a Mexicano government with Mexicanos in charge, there'll be a place for a few Norteamericanos. They would be very helpful in our trade with New Orleans, or in running stores in Victoria based on the New Orleans warehouses, or maybe even banking in Victoria with New Orleans funds. So from the 6th of March, when the Alamo fell, to the 21st, when news reached Santa Ana of the surrender of the Goliad garrison, Benito Garza luxuriated in the glow of victory, planning what he would do when this Mexicano army, with its 3 or 4 columns, had cleared Tejas of the Norteamericanos. But with the arrival of the sweating, dusty rider from Goliad, things changed dramatically. For Garza was in a house near San Fernando Church when he heard Santa Ana give the order, "I told Urrea specifically, no prisoners, no surrender. Remind him. Order him to shoot them all." Garza, as an expert on life in Tejas and a man who had educated himself by reading about Napoleon and other generals, felt obligated to remonstrate against such a brutal, such an unwarranted order. And there, in command headquarters, with no one else present, a vital dialogue began. Garza, "Excellency, may I respectfully suggest that you do not send Urrea that order?" Santa Ana, "Why not? My decree of the 30th of December, 1835, clearly states that any foreigner taking arms against the government of Mexico is to be treated like a pirate and shot." Garza, "But to shoot so many, more than 300, maybe 400, this will be taken poorly in Los Estados Unidos. It will incur lasting enmity." Santa Ana, with great animation, "Now there you're wrong, Garza. Remember what happened at Tampico just last December? A gang of Norteamericanos tried to invade, coming down from New Orleans. We defeated them and shot 28 of them as pirates. Everybody warned me, the people of New Orleans will rise up. Nobody made a move. They realized the dead men were pirates. They deserved to be shot, and I shot them." Garza, "But I'm worried, Excellency, that this Alamo thing might be differently interpreted. It didn't happen in Tampico. It happened here, and Norteamericanos interpret Béjar and Tejas differently from the way they do Tampico." Santa Ana, "Again, you're wrong. Our great victory here, and Urrea's in Goliad, will show them that Tejas really is an indivisible part of Mexico, that they no longer have any interest in it. They never did." Garza, "They think they did, and that's what counts. Look at what the messenger said about the men at Goliad who are to be shot if your order prevails. Men from Georgia, from New Orleans, and Louisville. Irishmen, Poles. This is not a collection of random volunteers like the Alamo." Santa Ana, very persuasively, his voice low and controlled, "The more reason they must be punished and openly. See that the order to Urrea goes out promptly." Garza, "Excellency, I must protest. I must." Santa Ana, "Are you a loyal Mexicano or a damned Norteamericano?" Garza, "I hope to be your governor of Tejas one of these days." Santa Ana, laughing, "And so you shall be, or someone like you, because from now on, Tejas is forever Mexicano." Garza, "So I speak as a future governor, if things go well." Santa Ana, "I'm sure they will. With Béjar and Goliad in our hands, with our men in control of the coast, with the Norte Americanos burning down their own towns, all we have to do is pin this Sam Houston down somewhere and finish him off. Clean out Nacogdoches, and never again allow a Norte Americano to live west of the Sabine.
Garza, a large order, Excellency.
Santa Anna, it's almost done.
Then, snapping his fingers, I'll make you my district governor at Nacogdoches. You can guard our frontier.
Garza, it is Nacogdoches, Excellency, that I'm worried about. Béjar and Goliad have fallen. Suppose you overtake Houston somewhere on the banks of the Brazos and wipe him out. Don't you see that this drags you all the way to the Louisiana border, and as you approach there, it's going to be like a spring? You compress it and compress it, and always it grows more powerful until, poof, it blows you apart.
Santa Anna, what do you mean?
Garza, I mean simply this, that you can annihilate the Alamo in fair battle, and that's acceptable, and you can defeat Fannin at Goliad, and that's acceptable. But if you shoot the Goliad prisoners and then march north, every man in Kentucky and Tennessee and Alabama and Mississippi is going to rally to the cause, so that when you reach the Sabine, you will face the whole Estados Unidos.
Santa Anna, if the Norte Americanos give me any more trouble, I may march all the way to Washington. The execution of the prisoners, that is a risk we must take. It's a risk I'm willing to take, because I feel sure that when they see the irresistible force of our armies, and remember, Garza, I'll have 8,000 shortly, and they'll have trouble mustering 1,000.
Garza, their 1,000 will be led by Sam Houston, and he's no Fannin.
Santa Anna, I know little about him. What kind of man is he?
Garza, most of us have never seen him.
Santa Anna, what have you heard?
Garza, he's drunk most of the time, but very clear-eyed when sober. He fought with their President Jackson against the Indians, but he also loves the Indians and is just in his treatment of Mexicanos. The Norte Americanos I know find him unfathomable.
Santa Anna, nothing but a frontier gallant.
Garza, but if you proceed with the execution of the Goliad prisoners, Excellency, you place a terrible weapon in the hands of this Houston.
Santa Anna, what weapon?
Garza, revenge.
Excellency, the Norte Americanos may forget the Alamo in time. It was a fair fight, and they lost. But they could never forget a massacre at Goliad. They will fight us every inch of the way. They'll cut our supply lines, and our lines will be very long.
Santa Anna, damn it, you sound like a Yankee.
Garza, I want to be governor of a state that can be governed. If we make a just settlement now, bring men like Houston into a decent companionship.
Santa Anna, slowly and with careful reasoning.
I have them by the throat, Garza. With reinforcements arriving every day, I have a chance to wipe them out. Another Zacatecas, another Tampico. Teach them a terrible lesson, pacify them, and go back to governing Mexico as it should be governed.
A long pause.
So the execution of the prisoners at Goliad must be seen as part of a grand design. All pieces fall into place, if you look at it that way.
Garza, pleading.
Excellency, there's one thing I haven't told you, haven't told anyone. But when you sent me into the Alamo to verify the bodies, Crockett and those, the first body I could name was that of my sister's husband, Xavier Campbell, a good Catholic from Scotland.
Santa Anna,
Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales. Why do men from such places come to fight against us? What business have they in Mexico?
Then, gently, I am sorry for your sister. I shall send her a present. Give her some land when this is over.
Garza, my point is, Excellency, that at the spot which this dead Xavier Campbell defended lay 9 dead Mexicanos. When you cross the Brazos, you will stand face to face with 1,000 Xavier Campbells.
Santa Anna, as if he had not heard.
So I want you, personally, to start writing right now with my message to General Urrea. Every prisoner he has must be shot. and if you do not report to me that this has been done, you will be shot. So, early on Thursday, the 24th of March, Benito Garza rode hard to Goliad in the company of three soldiers guiding extra mounts. He carried an order he did not want to deliver, and one which he certainly did not want to see obeyed. Knowing something of General Urrea, he hoped that this strong-minded professional would refuse to obey Santa Anna and would set the prisoners free. But when he reached the stout walls of the Presidio, with its 407 Norte Americano prisoners, including those taken from other areas, he found that General Urrea, anticipating such an order, had generated an excuse to go south, leaving the Presidio and its prisoners in the hands of a weak Colonel José Nicolás de la Portilla. Portilla's hands trembled when he opened the dispatch, and his face paled when he read the blunt command, "Immediate execution of every perfidious foreigner." He received these cruel instructions at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and spent the next hours in great anguish, because Urrea, on departing, had given him very specific orders of quite a different character. Treat the prisoners with consideration, especially their leader, Colonel Fannin, and protect them in every way, so long as they remain in your custody. So there it was. Shoot them all, or protect them until they're set free. Through the night he juggled these orders, and toward dawn he concluded that, whereas his immediate superior, General Urrea, knew what was the military thing to do under the circumstances, his ultimate superior, General Santa Anna, knew what was best for the nation, and was also in position to punish any subordinate who disobeyed his written order. About half an hour before dawn, on Palm Sunday, the 27th of March, Colonel Portilla rose, dressed in his finest uniform, and marched to the commissary, where he summoned his junior officers and told them, "We're to shoot them all." I said, "All." A great commotion engulfed the Presidio, with grim-lipped captains and lieutenants running here and there, and Lieutenant Colonel Juan José Holsinger still reassuring the Texicans, "We're marching you to the boats, home free." He believed what he was saying, because as a German known for his sympathies toward the prisoners, he had not been trusted with the truth. The prisoners, delighted at the prospect of being freed, were formed into three groups, with Finlay McNabb and his 14-year-old son Otto among the Georgia battalion that would march along the San Antonio River. "Can we be allowed to drop out when we pass our home?" McNabb asked Holsinger, who replied jovially, "Yes, yes, that's entirely reasonable." But just then, Otto shouted, "It's Benito!" And his cry attracted the attention of Santa Anna's messenger of death. And when Garza saw that the McNabbs, part of his family, were among the unknowing doomed, he moved away, lest they detect his anguish. "Benito!" the boy cried. And Holsinger, seeing this, turned to Garza and told him, "Friends of yours." So Benito had to speak with them. "We're going home at last," Otto cried, as he reached out to greet his friend. "Yes," Garza said. "You must stay close to me as we march out." "I want to," Otto said. And his father added, "Holsinger said we could drop out when we reached our home. Will you be joining us to help your sisters?" "Yes, yes." "Campbell was killed, wasn't he? A messenger from Gonzales said that he died. Were they all killed?" "Yes, yes." And in shame he moved away. Now the condemned Norteamericanos were told to form three separate columns and to move toward the main gate. They would march about half a mile, each in a different direction, and then they would be halted, each file out of sight of the others, but not out of hearing. They were well on their way when a male nurse ran into the large room where about 40 men wounded the week before lay on cots, Colonel Fannin among them, with a leg wound which had nearly killed him. "Drag them all into the yard, there to be shot," the nurse cried hysterically. And slowly, laboriously, the cots were dragged into the sunlight, where the men who had been saved from death now lay dumbly awaiting it. Colonel Fannin, from his cot, begged his men to act bravely.
Soon, Mexican soldiers began moving from cot to cot, jamming pistols against the heads of the men and blowing their brains out. Finally, only Fannin was left. West Point to the end, he never flinched, and assuming that his captors were gentlemen like himself, he made the kind of statement officers were supposed to make in a situation like this. "Sir, I give you my watch and my money with only two requests. Please do not shoot me in the face. Please see that I am decently buried with the honors of war."
When the blindfold was over his eyes, the officer who had accepted the watch asked, "Bueno?" And Fannin replied, "It is well placed." He was then shot right through the face, and his body was tossed on the pile with the others to be burned, with the charred remains left for the coyotes and the vultures.
These intimate details are known because just before the execution started, a compassionate Mexican officer, knowing that General Urrea's wounded needed medical care, moved quietly among the Texicans, selecting men who had proved helpful in caring for the sick. To each he whispered, "Move toward that corner. Hide." His personal courage in disobeying Santa Anna's cruel orders meant that some two dozen Texicans survived, and it was they who in later years reported the atrocity which was now about to unfold. The marching columns, 370 men in all, could not know what had happened to the wounded prisoners, and the Georgia battalion containing the McNabs was well on its way to the river, with some of the men singing, when it was ordered to halt. At this moment Benito Garza, who was with the troops, grabbed Otto by the left shoulder, whirled him about, pointed to the nearby woods, and said one word, "Run." The boy, bewildered, did not move, so Garza gave him a strong shove and muttered again, "Run." "My father!" "Run!" Garza shouted. And this both spurred the boy into action and alerted a wiry Mexican lieutenant with a sword who saw what was happening. He was about to chase after Otto, but the morning's work began, which temporarily delayed him. When the group of some 120 prisoners halted, the Mexican soldiers wheeled about, formed two lines, enclosing the Texicans, and upon command began to shoot each prisoner in the head. But when the captives realized the terrible thing that was happening, many started to fight their captors with bare fists, so that a general melee developed with much aimless firing. Otto, from his place among the trees, saw men from Tennessee grab the guns of their slayers and defend themselves with the butts until some Mexican shot them through the back of the head. Other men, wounded in the first fusillades, lay helplessly on the ground, looking up as soldiers came, pointed pistols directly in their faces, and blew their heads apart. He watched with horror as his father broke loose and started to run across the fields toward where he was hiding. And Finley might have escaped had not three officers on horseback galloped after him, stabbing him in the back with their lances, and cheering as he stumbled blindly about, the lances projecting from his back. Forming a circle about him with their horses, they fired at him six times and rode off. Desperately, Otto wanted to run out to help his father, but common sense told him that Finley was dead, so he retreated farther into the woods. And it was good that he did, because the officer who had seen him escape now came after him on foot, armed with sword and knife and pistol to finish him off. But the sight of this great peril gave Otto newfound strength. Grasping for anything, he wrenched loose a stout oak branch, and with a power that frightened him, stripped off the twigs. He now had a heavy weapon with which to defend himself. The officer, seeing the boy apparently defenseless, moved easily through the woods, brandishing his sword. And when he reached Otto, he gave a mighty flash with his right arm, bringing the point of the sword directly athwart Otto's neck. But the boy swerved, taking a deep cut from left ear to chin. So impassioned was he that he did not feel the cut or the flow of blood. But he fell to the ground as if mortally wounded, then jammed his oak branch between the officer's legs.
With a sudden twist, he threw the fellow down, grabbed his knife as it fell loose, and with three terrible stabs, he struck the man in the chest, in the gut, and deep in the neck. He had no time to assess his victory, because two other soldiers had heard the noise of the struggle and now closed in upon him. At first, as he ran for the river, he was so protected by trees that they could not use their rifles. But when he broke for the banks, they had a clear shot at him, and one bullet tore into his left shoulder, but did not shatter the bone. Disregarding this second wound as he had the first, he dashed to the edge of the steep bank. It was almost a cliff. And without thinking of hidden rocks or invisible tree stumps, he leaped into the water, submerged, and swam underwater for the opposite shore. This was a mistake, for it allowed the two soldiers to spot him when he surfaced. But before they could take proper aim, he was underwater again, swimming this time for the very bank on which they stood. When he surfaced this time, right under them, they were too surprised to shoot. So down he went again, with them firing at his wake. And when signs of blood bubbled up, they assumed that they had killed him. He had not moved. He had stayed right below them, holding his breath until he feared his lungs might burst. And this time, when he edged his nose above the water and then his eyes, he found that they had left.